You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
In 2000, I bought a small farm. I started my own business. I intended to grow my own food. I was designing a home where I thought I could retire. And in 2003, the gas industry came into our area, and my dream died.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Landmen for gas drilling companies are swarming Central New York, trying to talk landowners into signing mineral leases that will allow them to extract natural gas from the Marcellus Shale, a geological formation covering half of New York State, two-thirds of Pennsylvania, and parts of Ohio, West Virginia, and Virginia. Due to the high prices resulting from the peak in natural gas and new drilling methods, its extraction can now be profitable. The landmen make all sorts of promises to the owners, but tonight you're going to hear from people from Wyoming and Colorado who've experienced the reality. Their rural communities turned into corporate sacrifice zones. They came east to speak at a community forum in Walton, New York, organized by the Catskill Mountain Keepers.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Ramsey Adams. I'm the executive director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. And we're hosting this forum tonight with some incredible speakers. And I just wanted to thank you all for coming. Our website is CatskillMountainKeeper.org. You can find out more information about the work we do. But I'm going to hand the microphone over now to Wes Gillingham, who is the program director at Catskill Mountain Keeper, and put this event together. And he'll introduce the speakers and moderate tonight. So again, thank you for coming. And feel free to call us or go to our website tomorrow or whenever if you have questions following the forum if they don't get answered at the end during the Q&A session. Thanks again.
Hi, I'm Wes Gillingham, the program director for Catskill Mountain Keeper. This gas drilling issue for Mountain Keeper has, about 8 months ago, I was approached by a member who started telling me that people, the landmen, were working their area on the, in the Delaware River Valley, and that gas leases were taken out. And my first thought was, oh, I remember when my parents had a gas lease back in the late 60s and early 70s. And it made me start to find out, okay, what shale layer this is, and to do some of the research. And what I found out when I got on the internet was I was inundated with information about the Marcellus Shale, both industry publications, and then that led me to a lot of other investigations about the issues with this type of shale play. And for those of you, I know, not knowing how much research individuals have done here, what we have is a layer of shale that you've read about in the papers that has been here. They've known it's been here for a long time. There was some exploration done before, but it was never productive. And there's a few things that make it attractive now. One of them is the using the technologies of horizontal drilling, whereas when they're about 500 feet above the shale layer as they're drilling down, they turn the bore at a right angle and then drill 1,000, 2,000 feet. And I've heard some reports of up to 3,000 feet horizontally. And then they use a process called hydraulic fracking, which pushes components out into the, using chemicals and water and a thing they call proppants, or it gets referred to as sand, actually helps hold open the pores that they split open. So that technology, compiled with the fact that they're constructing the Millennium Pipeline, that has it's a major conduit for the gas, along with gas prices, all of a sudden we are seeing the landmen in our area. So Mount Keeper's first response in terms of, besides me just running around and getting overwhelmed with the amount of information there, was my response was, I need to find some folks that aren't starting and trying to learn this from square one. The gas companies, as everyone knows, these companies have a lot of resources and a lot of money. They know what they're doing, and they work really well coming into an area and getting the most out of a region in terms of removing the gas and making it very profitable. So starting from square one and trying to learn everything in 8 months, it made much more sense to me to try to contact people who have been dealing with the gas industry for many years. So many phone calls and a lot of complicated process. These are the folks that we were able to bring from out west. We have Jill Morrison from the Powder River Basin Council. Jill's going to talk to us about the challenges of gas development for landowners and mineral owners. And then we have Peggy Utish, who is going to explain how her community took a collaborative approach and negotiated a community development plan with the gas corporations. And Bruce is going to talk to us about how the challenges of natural gas development have affected and how they've been addressed in statutory and regulatory levels by the state and local governments. So I really look forward to their presentation. All three of these folks bring a lot of experience with dealing with this issue. I would like to thank the Walton Theater for allowing us to have this here, and Christina Hearn, who helped us set this venue up. And I would also like, there's a couple of organizations that have helped us in this process, and that's the Catskill Citizens for Safe Energy and the Damascus Citizens Group that helped us gain some information about this. So with that, I will turn this over to Jill.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here. Thanks to the Catskill Mountain Keeper for bringing us here. It's an honor for me to come to this part of the country. It's very beautiful. And my teenage daughter said to me yesterday, "Well, Mom, you're going to go and show them that you're a hick from Wyoming, but you'll show them because you're really a hick from Nebraska." So I was born and raised on a farm, and my agricultural roots still run deep in Wyoming. And I've worked for the past 18 years with landowners in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, landowners and mineral owners, trying to shape energy development and gas development in a way that reduces the impacts and increases the benefits. Let me go back to this. The area with the yellow circle around it is the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. It goes into Montana as well. It's one of the largest energy-producing areas in this country. We ship about 300 million tons of coal out of the Powder River Basin every year, and we're also one of the largest gas and oil-producing regions. The other red dots on this map are other current or proposed gas-producing areas. Just so you get an idea, there's been a huge explosion of natural gas development. And I hope everybody here, the reason I say this, and I hope you're not offended if I mention this, but a lot of people I've realized lately don't realize that there's a difference between natural gas and refined gasoline. When you talk about gas, people think you're talking about the gasoline in your car, which of course is refined from crude oil. This gas we're talking about here in my part of the country and a lot of the Rocky Mountain region is a natural gas, either in the tight sands or the coals, or in your case now here in the shales. It's natural gas. It's not gasoline, of course. This is the, and I am not an expert on the Marcellus Shale. What I hope to bring for you from the lessons we've learned in our area is some things to think about, some things to be ready for. I commend you for being here and wanting to learn about this, because this will bring a lot of challenges to you, and you need to be prepared. You need to get out in front of it if you want to shape it in a way that is most positive and most beneficial for you individually and for your communities. So this is the area I'm from in Wyoming, Bighorn Mountains there, border the Powder River Basin on the west and the Black Hills on the east side. It's about 25,000 square miles. And we have really important farming and ranching, and then really important wildlife hunting and recreation opportunities. We've got about a herd of about 165,000 antelope, about 110,000 mule deer, and I don't know, several thousand elk just in the Powder River Basin. So it's an area that's incredibly rich in biodiversity. River runs through it, more than one, but this is the Powder River. It's one of the last wild and undammed prairie rivers in North America. And we have very unusual fish species left in that river. This is a shovel-nosed sturgeon. And so I know you also have a lot of unique resources here that you care about besides this important gas resource. So I want you to think about how you balance the gas resource with your other important agricultural and wildlife and whatever fishing resources you've got. As I said, we've often been called the Saudi Arabia of energy development, the Powder River Basin, because we have so much coal mining on the eastern side of the basin. And in all of our adjacent states, starting in about the late 90s, early 2000, there was a huge rush. It was almost like the old gold rush for gas development in our states. And the landmen were running all over in the early 90s trying to lease up people's gas rights and telling them this was going to be the best thing that ever happened to them. And it's turned out to be a lot more difficult than people ever thought. Just in my area alone, and I don't know if you've all asked this question, but what does it mean? How many gas wells are we going to have? Well, we have started out one every 40 acres. Now we got one every 80 acres. In the other areas of Wyoming we work with, they're at 20-acre spacing on deep gas, tight sands gas. In just the area where I am, we have this boom which started in the early 90s and really hit a peak in about 97, started peaking. The Bureau of Land Management, which owns a lot of the minerals underneath people's surface, did an environmental impact statement. And so they approved the development of 51,000 what are called coal bed methane wells. That's where they get the gas out of the coal rather than the shale. And though there's some different things related to coal bed gas than shale gas, there are some things that are similar and some things you can relate. You've got to have miles and miles of roads of infrastructure to hook this development together. You've got to have pipelines. You've got to have power lines. We had to have pits and ponds for the produced water. And we're also losing a lot of water they're pumping out of our aquifers. Now, that may not be the same that's going to happen here, but I understand you are going to probably have a produced water, and you're going to need a lot of water potentially to get this gas out. So you need to think about, where are we getting that water? Where are we dumping that water? How is that going to happen, and how will that affect us? These are the kinds of folks I work with. Many of them are both mineral owners and landowners. The one thing that I think is very different in the West is that it's very rare for people to own all of their minerals. Because of the times the West was homesteaded, we have the split estate, and so oftentimes the surface was split from the mineral beneath it, and the mineral estate is essentially viewed as dominant, so that creates a whole other problem for us, and we've had a lot of issues with condemnation of the surface by the gas companies or the pipeline companies or the power line companies. That's been a very big issue. But what we see again is these are all new roads created for this gas development at 80-acre spacing. There's compressor stations and well pads and pipelines. And one of the things that we've realized about this industry, even though they come out and tell you, we're so regulated, we're one of the most regulated industries, we found that not to be true, at least both at the national level and at the state level. Particularly at our state level, it's a very coddled industry. They have to jump through a few hoops, but at the national level, they are not regulated like we regulate many other industries. They are not bonded for the cost of reclamation like coal companies are. That bond is not renewed. They have these blanket bonds nationwide for federal mineral development and then for fee development statewide of a few thousand dollars, blanket bonds, which are not covering the cost of reclamation. So you need to think about that. How is this going to be reclaimed when they're done? What's going to be left? We found huge problems with the spread of noxious weeds and just not getting the reclamation done. So that's kind of what's happening in our areas. Another, I just want to give you some examples since all these people can't come back here with me to talk with you. I like to bring their own words with me for you to read and for you to hear about, because this, it's a great thing to have this important resource, and believe me, the rest of the country wants it, and they're going to come and get it. And it's going to be an economic boom to your communities, which is going to bring some, and to your families, which is going to bring some good things, and it's going to bring some bad things. And again, I just can't emphasize enough how important it is for you to get out in front of this and shape it the way you want it to be in your individual lease agreements, in your surface agreements, in a community impact fees, in a community agreement. You need to begin to make a list of the things that are important to you, the things you want to see happen and how you can make those things happen. This is an example of a big pit to hold produced water from the coal bed methane development. These are a lot of water being pumped out, so they got to have a lot of pits. These are compressor stations. They're very noisy. You want to think about noise. One of the things we enjoy in rural areas is quiet. I don't know if they're going to have compressor stations for this gas to push it down the pipeline, but these are mainline compressor stations. And you want to ask some of those questions and think about where are those going to be located. You can construct them in such a way that they won't, the noise can be controlled, but you want to think about that. Again, this is this split estate issue, which I don't think you have much of here, but maybe there's some of it. If you can sever the minerals from the surface, which you may be able to do, maybe somebody sold off the minerals and you're just sitting on the surface, and that's been the cause of huge, huge problems in the West. And though we're joking about it in the Ziggy cartoon, it's been a big problem because these sorts of development, this is a drilling mud pit where when they're drilling the wells, they have to have a place to put the drilling muds, and they often contain a lot of different oils and solvents, and this one is unlined. And they just came onto this property, basically condemned their way on, and you have no say over what happens or really how it happens. And so we've had to work to try to bring the equity of the landowner in the West to have more power and more say in how that development happens. This is another example of a big pit for water. You can see how big it is. And again, this was on a ranch where they just came on with no agreement, no compensation. And one of the very big problems, I mean, in some ways, our area has been sort of a poster child for how to do it wrong rather than how to do it right. And the companies have really externalized the costs of this development onto the landowners, and landowners have not been properly compensated for all the impacts in our area. You can't really see this slide, darn. It's actually a ditch that was dug through this property to discharge produced water, and that ditch was condemned on this landowner as well as all the, there's still, I think they were in condemnation hearings yesterday and maybe the day before for drilling about 100 wells. They came onto this property, the Brannemans, they did negotiate an agreement, but then you've got to enforce that agreement. And the Brannemans had to go to court. We're finding that landowners and even mineral owners in our area are spending thousands upon thousands of dollars on lawyers to enforce agreements, for breach of contract, for damage to property, for lost water wells. And so there is this issue of treating people with respect, and I'm sorry to say that landmen in our area don't have a very good reputation. I don't know how many landmen are sitting in the audience. I hope you're different here. The motto in our area is, if their lips are moving, they're lying. They have a very bad reputation, and I hope it's different here. These are some of the things we've had to do and ways we've had to respond. We have had to pass specific laws in our state to strengthen the landowners' rights. We've had to pass specific regulations to try to increase the bonding. And those are some things you really need to look at and think about in your state, in your area. What do we need to go to? What kind of laws do we have to protect ourselves? What kind of rules and regulations do we need to get out in front of this? We've also had to go in and at our public resources and on our private lands, we've had to do the research. We have had to gather the baseline. And at least some of this on the public resources, like our waterways, we raised the money and hired an organization to do some of the baseline studies on the fisheries that we wanted to protect. We were able to, in some ways, shame our state agencies to then come to the table to do that. But you need to get your baseline data. I'm happy to answer questions about that later on. You want to think about all these roads and all the dust has been a huge issue in our area with the air quality, both for livestock, wildlife, and people. We do live in a very arid area, and the volumes of traffic have increased 100-fold. On a county road where you used to see a dozen cars a day, you might now get 100 vehicles, trucks, and trailers, and there's a lot of traffic. I want to move to another part of Wyoming. This is in the Bighorn Basin. This is drilling that's been going on in deep gas, tight sands gas. And this is a picture taken of a blowout occurring in this well, even where they had blowout preventers. And this blowout released several hundred tons of toxic chemicals that were used in the hydraulic fracturing, this was the drilling and production, drilling process where the well blew out, lost circulation, and they had to evacuate people in the community for, I think it was about 3 days. And now people are dealing with groundwater contamination from the chemicals used in the drilling process. So you want to be thinking about some of those issues. This is another well blowout that happens in an area where there's a lot of also deep gas drilling. And this was supposed to be a water well that was being replaced. Water wells have been contaminated there from the gas drilling. And when they started drilling this well, they hit gas and it blew out. And that family has gone several years now. The company's been hauling them water. They've been trying to get their water well replaced, but it hasn't happened yet. This is on the west side of Wyoming. This is on the Jonah Field. This is at about 20-acre spacing. There's a little community near there called Pinedale. It's about 80 miles south of Jackson, Wyoming. And that little community has, from the gas development that's occurring there, and this is, again, a deep gas, tight sands gas, has now exceeded the ozone levels from the gas processing and drilling facilities. They have ozone in the wintertime higher than Los Angeles or Houston, and they've got a population of about 1,000 people. So there are health issues, and there are emissions from these facilities, and you need to ask a lot of questions about that and think about that. And right now that little community is trying to figure out, because ozone can be a very, it's permanently damages your lungs. They're asking for a non-attainment of that little community area from EPA for the air. This couple also owns their minerals. They were leased their minerals, thought that it was going to be a good thing for them, thought they had things covered. And then they realized that, well, they had things maybe covered in their lease agreement. They were getting downstream impacts and impacts coming to them from adjacent properties that were not anticipated. A lot of this water where we are is dumped into drainages and ephemeral streams, and people downstream are flooded, and their best meadows have been destroyed. And it usually requires in families one person full-time to manage and police this type of development in our area. I don't know what it will be like for you, but you got to think about how much time and effort. This is the flooding they had on their ranch. And this water, though, it's mostly pretty good for using for domestic or livestock use. You can't put it on our clay soils, and it just deposits salts, has higher sodium, and leaches all the salts out of our clay soil. So it's rendered a lot of soil unusable. And then we have all sorts of erosion that's been caused by some of the produced water discharges. And so we have had to try to address this issue and make some comments out of it, but it's been a challenge. And so we petitioned for our own rules to try to deal with this development. And I can't tell you how powerful this industry is. They will bring in busloads of people. And these folks who are from Colorado can talk more about this and tell you that, you know, everybody's going to lose their jobs if they have to do it right or do it better. And it's just not true. But they do, they carry, they have so much money and a lot of clout. And, you know, there's ways to make them do it right. And our certainly our state and federal governments can do that. We've also gone out in advance and again, set up our own monitoring, put out our whole protocol, trained ourselves so that we know if they start dumping produced water from the gas production into our streams, we know it. And it also acts as a preventative measure. And one of the very big issues and for us is water and loss of our potable water or contamination of water. And many people where I am have lost their water wells, and particularly, you know, valuable artesian wells. And so it's a very expensive proposition to drill new wells and get new wells or try to get the gas companies to do that. So you want to make sure you think about that and have that issue covered in your agreements. Again, you also want to think about areas, this area for us, that you want to keep intact, that you don't want any drilling yet. Do we have areas in around here, or do you have areas, we certainly do, that we have asked for no drilling to be in, that we're working on. And another huge issue is how it's impacted our wildlife. This is the sage grouse, greater sage grouse, in areas where this development occurs that's dropped 85% decline in the population. It's now petitioned for listing for the endangered species list. And so very big issue on certain wildlife species that if they get listed as endangered, it affects everyone, not just the gas industry. So we need to make sure it's done right. One of the things I want to ask you to think about is there are going to be so many, there's so many complexities to this type of development, and you can't always think of them all. But one of the most important lessons we've learned is to not let it go everywhere all at once. It should be very carefully managed in a phased approach with certain standards that industry has to achieve before they can move into the next area. And you can also learn a lot of lessons that way. You know, like what needs to be done better, how we've done it wrong. But I would really encourage a phased development approach. Don't let it go scattershot everywhere all at once if you can help it. And that's really where maybe you can get your state to really help you out. So thank you very much. I really appreciate your interest.
So while we're dealing with the technical stuff here, I would like to ask the audience, and first of all, thank you very much for coming tonight. I have to tell you from the heart that as somebody who's been impacted by this industry because we were behind the curve when they came in, it means an incredible amount to me to see this kind of a turnout in a community. Community is the theme that you're going to hear me talk about again and again tonight, and standing together as a community to make this development work for you. So having the opportunity, as Jill said, to get out ahead of it is huge. I'd like to ask for a show of hands in the audience. How many of you own your mineral rights and have leased your mineral rights? How many of you are in city or county government that are here interested in this? Okay, a few hands. And how many people are just landowners who are here to learn more? Okay, that's most of you. And do we have any industry folks in the audience? Okay. No. They're not fessing up if they're out there. My story is a personal journey. Some of the things that you're going to hear me say are echoes of what you've already heard Jill say. But I also touch on a lot more community issues that have more to do with managing drilling in a less rural setting. The gas in Colorado is very similar to, I think, what you're going to experience here. It's called, you heard her use the term, tight sands. The gas in Colorado is trapped in lenses in sandstone anywhere from 3,000 to 9,000 feet deep. And those little lenses get broken apart. Industry drills down, and then they use a technique called fracking, where they pump fluid under pressure underground to break the tight sands apart and get the gas in the little lenses to pool into a big place where they can pump it out. It's my understanding from the research that I've done and the folks I've talked to up here that it's that same type of fracking and deep sand, it's a different formation than we have, but it's that same technology that's going to be used in your area. So I think many of the things you'll hear me talk about are going to be applicable to you. So as I was introduced, I'm Peggy Utesh. I'm a Colorado native. I'm an author and an editor. I'm a senior fellow with the American Leadership Forum and a small business owner. And I've won some awards for the work that I do. But if you asked industry between 2003 and 2005 who I was, they would tell you that I was one royal pain in the ass. I was living the American dream. In 2000, I bought a small farm. I started my own business. I intended to grow my own food. I was designing a home where I thought I could retire. And in 2003, the gas industry came into our area, and my dream died. My mile-long road that saw maybe 10 cars a day suddenly had 100 semi-trucks a day up and down that road for several years. This particular road in the picture was directly across from my house, and it was gated because there were horses on the other side of that gate. And so every time a truck came up to that gate, they stopped, and their headlights shone right in my front window. This is a practice called flaring. If you remember the picture of the waste pit that Jill showed you, when tight sands gas is drilled, there's a lot of lubricants, which is typically diesel fuel and other petrochemicals that are used to lubricate the drill bit. And as that waste comes back out of the ground, it's held in large pits. And when it gets too icky, it's flared. And this is a picture of a gas flare. Those happened on a regular basis. And if it was a windy day, that blew back over my house and I got to breathe it. What's in that? Carcinogenic chemicals, in particular BTEX, which is benzene, ethyl xylene, toluene, and xylene, all highly volatile and highly carcinogenic. This is a picture of a well blowout that happened on a pad less than a half a mile from my house. A condensate tank overpressurized and it spewed drilling waste across the well pad, as well as 40 acres of prime grazing land, stock ponds, and irrigation ditches. When industry came to clean this mess up, they cleaned up the well pad, and they didn't do a darn thing about any of the contamination on private property until we raised holy hell. My mantra in those days was make it go away. Oil and gas is the single richest industry in the world. It's their game. It's like being asked when they show up with a lease in their hand and want you to make a fast decision. It's like being asked to play a complicated board game, but nobody tells you the rules. Between 2003 and 2005, more than 30 natural gas wells were drilled within a mile of my home, and in 2004, there were over 35 regulation violations on those well pads, including the single largest accident in Colorado history. Industry told us they were drilling at 9,000 feet, and they patch on the head like you don't know anything. You know, ma'am, there's an awful lot of land. It's just solid rock between where we're drilling and the surface. There's just no way that gas can get up. You're safe. Well, guess what? It's the Rocky Mountains, and our geology is highly fractured. And 115 million cubic feet of natural gas escaped underground and subsequently leaked to the surface, contaminating water wells, sickening people, and killing livestock. I got mad, and I fought hard to change the system. As a public relations professional, I got their name in the paper every day. Why was I angry? As I got into the fight, I learned that the state's Oil and Gas Commission was a seven-member board, five of whom were from industry. Industry was making the rules, kind of like the fox guarding the hen house. There was a lack of an inspection and oversight. Of the 65,000 acres that comprise Western Colorado's 21 counties, there were two gas inspectors at a time where there were thousands of well permits being issued every year. I exposed a lot of their bad practices in the newspapers and in radio interviews, but it did nothing to change how they operated until Antero Resources came in. Where I live in Western Colorado, it's called the Grand Valley. And in the bottom of this valley lies I-70 and the Colorado River. On the south side of the interstate where I lived, most of the ranches were 300 to 1,000 acres. It was still one of the most richest agriculturally producing areas on the I-70 corridor. On the north side of the interstate was an area called Silt Mesa, and most of the ranches up there were 10s and 40s. Everybody thought because of that dense residential development that there would be no natural gas drilling, but we found out we were wrong when Antero Resources showed up and started buying mineral rights. So I was asked to speak at a community forum much like this, and Antero stood up and they told the community what a great job they were going to do for them, and I stood up and I said, bullshit. This is what the development has done in my side of the river. Well, Terry Dobkins from Antero Resources came up to me after that forum and he said, you know, I hope you will give us the opportunity to prove that we're a different kind of a company. And I smiled and I left and I went home and I thought, yeah, right. But the more I thought about it, I thought maybe I could turn this into an opportunity. So I came up with the idea with talking with other people to come up with what we called a community development plan. And the idea was to create a partnership between community and industry that gave residents a voice in how the development happened in their area. It would force industry to utilize best practices, which was not happening. It would improve communication and problem solving between the community and industry. And it would protect the community's values, property values, which were being dramatically impacted, as well as everybody's quality of life. So we started with a community forum much like this, and over 300 people came to that particular forum, and we said, well, what do you think if we try something that's never been tried before? You guys think it's worth a shot? Over 100 people signed up to participate, and at a subsequent meeting in February, we had 200 people that showed up. We identified the community's values. We spent a lot of time hearing about what their concerns were, and that became the core of the plan that we worked around. I took all of that information after the meeting in February, and I sat down with Terry Dobkins, and I said, what's the next step? We formed a work group that met biweekly, and in the weeks that the work group wasn't working, four members negotiated with Antero, and back and forth we went. We solicited input from industry experts, communities, and government entities, and we finally had a draft by November that we circulated back to the community to ask if we had done a good job. Did we meet all of the things that you needed? And for the most part, we had. And so in December that year, we signed a plan. It was endorsed by the towns of Newcastle, Silt, and Rifle, which are the three municipalities that surround Silt Mesa. It was also endorsed by Colorado's Ken Salazar, who said it was a new paradigm for how communities and industry could work together rather than being adversaries. Wyoming and New Mexico have adopted parts of our plan, as have many other counties in Colorado and New Mexico. We took a lot of heat about the community development plan because it's not a legally binding document. What we knew was if we got lawyers involved, we would never get industry to the table. The other thing that we recognized is that we were doing something that had never been done, and although we were putting things in the plan that we thought would work, once they were implemented, they might not, as well as the fact that once we got the plan up and running, there may be things that we overlooked. And if we had to go back to attorneys and get industry to sign new documents every time we made a change, it was going to be onerous. So we agreed to make it a gentleman's agreement. What the plan does is establish a framework for how development will proceed across Silt Mesa. It encourages landowners to work together. Now, we heard a little bit about fractionalizing communities, and I think that's one of the most dangerous things that you have to think about. Gas drilling will create the haves and have-nots. You'll have people and businesses that make a huge amount of money from this industry, and you will have people that are financially devastated and who will leave your community. And if I'm a landowner and a well is going to be drilled on my property, you better believe I'm going to put that well as far away as I can from my house, but guess what? It's right in your face. So what we wanted in the community development plan was for groups of neighbors to sit down together and say, where can we put these well pads that works for everybody so that one person isn't impacted and someone else receives no impact? Jill showed you some pictures of spacing. There are two types of spacing that you need to understand that you'll hear industry talk about, surface spacing and downhole spacing. Surface spacing is how densely well pads can be clustered on the land. Downhole spacing is how densely the bores can be drilled. In Colorado, we have 40-acre surface spacing, but we have as dense as 10-acre downhole spacing in some areas. So every well pad that you see here might have four wells on it that are drilled out directionally. What we wanted to see in the community development plan, well, let me, before I go there, imagine that this was agricultural land. Imagine that you were a dairy farmer and you're trying to irrigate that. Imagine that this is area that produces hunting and fishing revenue up on the forests. The town of Rifle receives $4 to $5 million a year in hunting and fishing revenue from recreationists that come to our state. But if this type of development happens on the forest, their recreational economy is dead in the water. So the community development plan guideline number one was about clustered well development. The technology exists to drill as many as 32 wells directionally from a single pad. They can drill out a half a mile or more at this point. And the technology is improving every day. So what we wanted industry to do was to cluster development so it had minimal impact. Now, that's not going to be appropriate in every area, but we felt that if neighbors got together and said, okay, let's have one big well pad in their area, and where can we put it? Maybe it's behind a hill so we don't have the noise and lights. It's away from everybody's homes. How can we make this a win-win situation for most of the landowners? We wanted to manage drilling in sensitive areas, and if you might think of wetlands and wildlife, which are on our list, we were more concerned about things like school bus routes. In the rural areas, you've got children standing out on the side of the road waiting for a school bus while hundreds of semi-trucks are flying by, and let me tell you what, those boys don't abide by the speed limit. We were also concerned about how close drilling could happen. State guidelines said that a well could be drilled within 150 feet of your home. Imagine that. We asked Antero Resources to do a better job than that, and they agreed. We also have a lot of organic agricultural in our area, and we wanted to be sure they weren't impacted. There's drilling that takes place within city and town limits and near subdivisions, near waterways, watersheds, dams, and irrigation systems. So the community development plan looks at all those areas. Continuity of development was another thing. The goal was to impact an area once rather than repeatedly. Where I lived, industry came in and drilled for almost a year, and when they left, we thought they were done. 2 months later, they were back, and they were back for 4 months, and then they left again, and we thought they were done, and then they were back, and then they left, and then that is highly anxiety-producing. And when you would ask them, what's your plan, they couldn't tell you what their plan was. And so what we wanted Antero to do was to be mindful, to create a plan that moved across Silt Mesa in an organized way, so once they were done drilling in an area, the landowner could be assured that they were not coming back. We also wanted them, Antero, to use responsible development best practice technologies. Well, here's a fancy definition, but this is what it looks like. I'll let you read the list, but I'm going to focus on the first thing on that list, which is water well testing, which Antero agreed to do. When the Divide Creek seep accident happened and people's water wells were contaminated, and not only contaminated with natural gas, but other chemicals that are used in the drilling process, and also when they're fracking, even though they were fracking at 4,000 feet underground at my home, I could sit and watch my wall shake. If there was water in a basin, it vibrated. It shakes the whole ground. It vibrated my holding tank and my well off its pedestal and broke all of the pipeline. That's how much it shakes. And so that increases total dissolved solids and can make potable water unpotable. But what we found out with Divide Creek was that if you don't have your water well tested prior to any impact, you can't take industry to court because you have no proof of what your water well was before industry arrived. Community development plans number 5 through 10 were about monitoring activities during drilling, plugging and abandonment of wells. Weed control is a big one. The number one way that weeds are spread, truck tires. Interim and final reclamation was an issue, community health and safety, and addressing the community's financial impacts, which I'll talk about in a minute. There was also a community education component. We felt that an informed community is a good partner. Always get a second opinion. Do not rely on industry as your sole source of information. We believe that better understanding means that you can negotiate better with industry, you can hold them accountable, you can be a creative problem solver, and you can reduce conflict. The implementation of the plan created a community board that met on a monthly basis with industry. We distributed written copies of the plan to all 1,600 landowners on Silt Mesa. We asked industry to provide the community with quarterly drilling updates so that we knew what was going on, what was planned for the next quarter. And we also built in a way to review our plan on a periodic basis so that things that weren't working could be changed, maybe something could be taken out or added, but the plan would stay current. The big thing was community participation, and that's what had not been happening with the natural gas development that had happened where I lived. So that's the community development plan process. I wanted to also go over quickly with you some of the other areas that Colorado has been proactive with the gas drilling in our state. Colorado has reformed the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So rather than a 7-member board, 5 of whom are from industry, it's now a 9-member board and only 3 are from industry. The other people at the table are landowners, city and county representatives, Division of Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management, and Forest Service. Everybody that's impacted by this industry has a seat at the table to say how the development is planned and what the regulations are. So this revised commission is now in the process of updating Colorado's regulations, many of which were written during a time when the technologies that we have today did not even exist. And can't remember what I was going to say. Anyway, they're being updated, which is huge. Another thing that Colorado did, the 2005 Energy Policy Act exempted the oil and gas industry from stormwater runoff regulations, and Colorado took that to the Supreme Court and won the right. The Supreme Court said that states have the right to oversee stormwater runoff, and so stormwater runoff rules apply to industry in our state for all of the well pads and all of the roads that are built for the natural gas industry. A lot of municipalities and counties are now charging impact fees, and there are some strings attached to that, but again, that was a court case that went all the way to Colorado's Supreme Court saying that cities and counties do have the right to levy those fees. Waste pits, as I was talking about earlier, that used to be able to be as close as 150 feet to homes have to be a half a mile away now. The State Gas Commission is also mandated to protect public health, wildlife, in conjunction with other state agencies. The state's Air Quality Control Commission has approved new restrictions to curb ozone-forming compounds that come off the condensate tanks in the drilling process. As Jill mentioned to you, that's a huge issue. You have to understand that ozone is the single largest contributor of asthma in this country. Passage of municipal watershed protection ordinances is another thing that we're starting to see. There are several municipalities in Colorado that have passed these ordinances, and I brought that information with me that I will share with the Mountain Keepers so that you can look at those ordinances and see if that's something that's of interest to your community. Some of the impacts that you might not anticipate from industry. The town of Rifle, which is sort of the epicenter of where drilling happens in western Colorado, saw their population double in a matter of 3 years. It went from 7 to 14,000 people. They had built a brand new municipal water system that went online in 2000. It was supposed to last until 2030. It's over capacity right now. Emergency preparedness was a huge issue. There was a condensate a semi-truck that was hauling condensate away from a well pad that rolled. And when the emergency responders showed up to deal with the emergency, everybody was overcome by fumes, and the emergency responders ended up in the hospital. Nobody knew what to expect, what kind of accidents, what kind of chemicals to be prepared for. So your emergency planning is something that's very important. The hospitals in our area were overwhelmed with injuries. Guys coming in out of the well fields that had severed arms, severed fingers, all sorts of serious accidents, and they weren't staffed to deal with that number of emergencies. Fire protection. Rural fire protection districts, many of which were primarily volunteer, were suddenly being asked to deal with fires that were of a chemical nature, and they had no idea how to do that. They knew how to fight forest fires. Roads and bridges. The roads in most rural areas are not built to handle heavy-duty truck traffic, and so a lot of the roads in our area had to be upgraded, and for a while, that happened at the county's expense, until county wised up and made industry pay for the improvements in the road structures. Heavy traffic. My 1-mile-long road came onto the main highway at a blind corner. Now, if 10 cars a day are using that intersection, that's not a problem. If you've got 100 semi-trucks going through that intersection, it becomes a huge problem. And another thing was housing shortages and skyrocketing rents. The resort town of Glenwood Springs is about 30 miles from Rifle. And because it's a resort town, it's kind of pricey. So most of the service workers for the hotels, motels, restaurants lived in Rifle and on West. Well, once the gas drilling came in, every single open space got rented, and rents skyrocketed. Every campground that used to be used by hunters is now trailers that have oil and gas drillers. And what ended up happening in Glenwood was that stores in their malls closed, restaurants closed, because they couldn't find workers who could afford to live in our valley and make minimum wage. So I would say to you, be proactive. Educate yourself, educate your community. Don't be rushed into false deadlines. One of the things that you need to understand about landmen is landmen, at least in Colorado, seldom work for any particular gas company. These guys are subcontractors, and they get paid by industry based on how many leases they get. And a lot of them are unethical. So when they come in and negotiate with you, they know who's paying their paycheck. They're going to negotiate a lease that benefits industry, not you. And so one of the things that I do professionally now is sit through, as a landowner representative, surface use negotiations. And I tell you to work with a lawyer, because oftentimes I've sat through those negotiations and we've gotten a whole lot of stuff. And the next day when we go to sign it at the attorney's office, many of the things that were in the contract yesterday are suddenly missing today. And the industry will kind of laugh and they'll say, guess we printed out an old copy. Well, you know, I would believe that if it hadn't happened over and over again. Be creative. Ask for what you want. This is, again, the single richest industry in the world. Don't be afraid to ask them to mitigate the impacts that happen in your community and stand together with your community to protect your values. Insist on being able to participate and insist on a fair shake. Thanks.
Peggy Utesh from the Grand Valley Citizens Alliance in Colorado. You're listening to a community forum held in Walton, New York, on the destructive impacts of gas drilling as the gas industry makes a move on central New York. This program will be available as an MP3 for download at the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org. I urge you to make a copy and give it to your neighbors before they're talked into signing leases. If you don't have the computer skills to make copies, email me through the website and I'll make a copy for you. I'll give this info again at the end of the show. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We continue with the community forum on the impacts of gas drilling held recently in Walton, New York.
Good evening. I'm Bruce Basil. I'm a staff attorney for the Oil and Gas Accountability Project, which is a nonprofit group. We only deal with oil and gas issues. We came into being because there seemed to be nobody out there advising folks on kind of the impacts of oil and gas when we came about in 1999. I live in the southwest part of Colorado. It's up pretty high, 7,200 feet. Most of my work in the past 5 years in particular has been working either in state legislatures or with counties on how to address some of the issues that you've heard Jill and Peggy talk about. So that could be state legislation, the rulemaking that Peggy mentioned. I just flew out here from Denver. We're in the middle of that rulemaking right now about how to rework these rules so that you take care of some of these issues. Last year we did the same thing in New Mexico, where the industry is also very active. They're an important part of the economy there. And there was a very lively debate about, how far can you go on addressing some of these issues? Are you going to run companies out of the state? So that's really been my work the last couple of years. The other area where I've been working quite a bit is then with local government, municipalities, counties, in general, and I, in preparation for this, I was asked to kind of look at what the New York setup is. Counties, municipalities, on the whole, can most appropriately address what happens on the surface.